Welcome to the She Wore Black podcast. I'm Agatha Andrews. Today, Chanel Cleeton joins me to talk about House on Biscayne Bay, her new book that explores Gothic through a Cuban Floridian lens. We discuss the difference between writing this novel after her previous and popular historical fiction books that also center Cuban characters in history, and we have fun discussing how she created Gothic atmosphere with opulence and peacocks. I have House on Biscayne Bay in my bookshop if you want to support both the podcast as well as independent bookstores nationwide at bookshop.org/shop/sheworeblack. If you want another way to help out my show, you can follow me on Instagram, Facebook, and Threads and leave me a review wherever you get your podcasts. You can also join my Patreon community, buy merch, or make a coffee donation through the links available on my website at sheworeblackpodcast.com. Thanks for joining me today. Now, on to the show. Well, thank you so much, Chanel, for joining me on the show today. It is my honor to have you here.
Thank you so much for having me. I am thrilled to be here.
You know, it's a Gothic mystery and horror podcast. So I know you have all these wonderful historical fiction novels that I am interested in. I've had a long interest in of course, when, okay, so let me back up. I went to college in the 90s, in the mid 90s, and that's when I discovered, people that looked like me could write books and create art, because we never talked about that before, you know, in high school or anything, especially in the 90s. And one of the books, the first book I saw that had people that looked like me was like Water for Chocolate. And I've talked about that a lot on the show. But the second book that I became obsessed with, I don't know if you know this one, Dreaming in Cuban by Cristina Garcia.
I do, yes.
Yes, I was so obsessed. And then I went on to write like a whole, like I have an art history degree, and I wrote a whole like 18-page paper on post-revolutionary art from Cuba and all this stuff. So this is very exciting that you've written a Gothic, and now like I'm like, this fits perfectly for the show. So this is very exciting for me.
Oh, thank you so much.
Well, I feel like we were also overdue for a Gothic that centered Cuban characters, because there's so many rich and beautiful things that you can draw upon for a Gothic novel. But I also like that being Cuban wasn't the whole story. So I often feel like I'm expected to perform my ethnicity. And this was so refreshing, because these were Cuban characters just existing in a story without it being the whole story. So can you speak to writing your Gothic in this way?
Sure. So for me, you know, I think as a Cuban American, I have written quite a few historical fiction books that really are centered on Cuban identity. A lot of them either, you know, from the perspective of being first generation, like me being, you know, the first generation born in this country, or, you know, kind of being a Cuban exile and going through that. And so I've written quite a few books really exploring Cuban identity, and I've enjoyed that. But I also wanted to try something different. And with The House on Biscayne Bay, and then the book that I actually published before it, The Cuban Heiress, it was more an opportunity, like you said, just to kind of have Cuban characters sort of living their lives. Obviously, with the close proximity between the US and Cuba, you know, there's all these different cultural interchanges that I think sometimes people don't really realize were going on prior to the Cuban Revolution. I mean, everyone always thinks of 1959 and obviously the exodus from Cuba as the time when we saw this huge immigration pattern into the United States. But, you know, in reality, the U.S. and Cuba have had kind of intricate relations for quite a bit. And I've written that in several of my different books. So I wanted to explore that, and just the idea, like you said, of just, you know, Cuban characters being here at this mansion in South Florida. And really the book kind of dictated the focus for me. You know, it really felt like the house was the focus, the Gothic setting. And so I sort of went with that as the direction for the characters.
Yeah. And I like that you've done all of those things, you know, like with your previous work. And that's one of the things I loved about, for example, I was talking about Dreaming in Cuban, like mm-hmm. where it explored all of that through three generations of women. And I just found that fascinating. And I went and delved into a lot of history. And I think fiction is really wonderful, because it can really enlighten us in mm-hmm. a way that humanizes what we learn about politically. So I love that you've done that. But at the same time, I think it's, you know, as a reader and a writer, I love the opportunity, or I'm creating opportunities to just explore existing in story, you mm-hmm. know. So I really enjoyed that. I do have a question though about Miami, which is interesting because I know you have this like huge academic background in politics. And so I love that you incorporated Miami history in a way that showed the glitz and glamour of the time, but it also exposed this underbelly that perfectly lent itself to Gothic. Was it the history that drove the Gothic narrative for you, since, you know, again, you have that huge political background, or did you want to write a Gothic and this history worked well for that narrative?
So that's a great question. For me, with this book in particular, it was really the history. I write historical fiction, and I write a lot of books that are centered on either Cuban history or Florida history. I'm originally from Florida. I was born and raised in the state. And so I have a lot of passion for Florida history. And so I was really looking at time periods that I hadn't written in before. I've kind of traversed a decent amount of the 20th century, and I wanted to try something different. And I really was kind of inspired by this time when we have people kind of in the early 1900s and then post-World War I moving to Florida and building kind of these elaborate mansions and leading up to the big land boom in the 1920s. And just the idea of what that must have been like, you know, Florida at that time, obviously South Florida and Miami was, you know, relatively remote in terms of, you know, cities like New York where they're moving down. And I wanted to explore kind of that fish out of water sense of what that must have felt like for someone to come down here and, you know, have the natural wildlife that can be intimidating in the weather and, you know, all those things that perhaps you weren't quite used to. And so Anna's story was really the one that came to me first. It was that opening chapter, that scene of her husband kind of springing this on her that they were going to be moving from the city to down to Miami and that he was building this huge mansion. And then once I had that scene in place and I started thinking about the house and the architecture that we have here in South Florida, you know, places like the Biltmore that are kind of reportedly haunted and mansions like Vizcaya, Henry Flagler's house up in Whitehall, up in Palm Beach, you know, I really felt like those grand homes lent themselves to this Gothic atmosphere. And we typically see Gothics in, you know, cold weather places or overseas. But the more I thought about what Florida's nature is like, it really felt just like the perfect place to set a Gothic novel for me. So that was really where the Gothic took off and really took a life of its own.
You said something I find interesting, which is that Anna's story came first and this whole idea of fish out of water, but your sisters are fish out of water too. Geographically being close, like Havana being close to Miami, yes, it's closer than it is to New York, but they are still fish out of water. There are still cultural differences. It's still not their native country. They're without their parents. They're on their own. Like I just find that interesting that you've made different ways for all of them to be fish out of water.
Well, and I will be honest, that is probably kind of a recurring theme in a lot of my different books. I do kind of tend to gravitate toward that. And I think that probably is coming from a background, you know, where my family came here as refugees and very much kind of had to start over and go through that experience. I think that is kind of a core narrative that I tend to return to. And it's not even intentional necessarily. I just find it kind of in my books over and over again. But I liked the idea of paralleling, you know, how they both were in these situations where they were sort of isolated. And I think that's such a hallmark of a Gothic too. Yeah. You know, if you think about it, often it's a physical isolation, but in here you have different levels of that kind of isolation and how that can play with your senses and your sense of, you know, security or your ability to trust those around you. And so I felt like all of that just really lent itself well to the Gothic genre.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, because one of the things we talk about on my show a lot is the isolation of Gothic and also agency. And these three women being the fish out of water, and especially because men were still pulling the strings, you know, or they didn't have agency either in the same way. And so that, or in the same way that an American born woman might, or that, I mean, well, I guess Anna was American born, but you know, there was just always a way where they were fighting for agency. And so I just found that really interesting that like, it was perfect for Gothic, you know, like the way that you're exploring themes you've explored before made it perfect for Gothic. And one of the things that you did that twisted it a little that I thought was really nice was that, you know, a lot of times, and I know there's a moment where the mansion is shown in decay or that, but really it was more, it had been repaired. Like by the time we're seeing it, you know, the decay was not in the picture. It was really more just a reference to, oh, it had fallen out and it's been fixed now. But what you showed was that isolation, dread, mystery, you know, all of those things can happen in an opulent setting. It doesn't have to be in a state of decay. And it's almost more terrifying because it should be safe, but that's unsettling because we know it's not.
No, absolutely. And I think, you know, that is another thing I kind of like to explore is that dichotomy of, you know, as you said, being in a situation that feels like it should be paradise. I think, you know, the characters make that reference and instead, you know, they realize quickly that appearances are not what they seem. And that also, I think, fit the Miami setting so well, because that's really something, you know, societally that I think you can say, particularly in that time period when you had, you know, a lot of different just kind of like swindles and scams going on and people trying to make their fortune at any cost in Miami, and what those stakes were like at that time and honestly continuing throughout history.
I love having gothics in settings that we don't typically expect. Like New England and England are very common settings. We've had a few now with like Selby Moreno Garcia and Isabel Cañas, setting them in other places. So this was definitely fun to see a Miami setting. But I thought, and I tapped into the peacocks for a reason. They were an interesting touch to me, but we have a park here in Austin, Mayfield Park, that was originally built for, you know, a society couple. And they had like, as one of their gifts, they had a couple of peacocks given to them. And so today it's a city park and it's gorgeous. And we have, there's a ton of peacocks and they're all descended from that original group of peacocks. And metaphorically, peacocks can do a lot of work. So everything that you're doing with peacocks in the story, I was paying extra attention to, because you give us a few gator moments, you know, you give us the obligatory Florida gator, but the peacocks are really the core animal that you used, and you used them in interesting ways. And so I'm interested in how you came to use them. They showed the glitz. I mean, there was just so much metaphor going on with them. I was hoping you could speak to that a little bit.
Sure. So that was a really fun thing to add in. And so the peacocks are all over Miami. If you come, it's kind of something you see everywhere you go. It's actually something they're kind of addressing because, like what you said, you know, a few peacocks has turned into this enormous peacock population down here. And so they started off as kind of a similar, you know, thing to the story you mentioned, where it's, to the best we kind of know, wealthy landowners kind of brought them in to add them on the properties, and then they began reproducing, and now they're everywhere. So it felt like something to put in that was very organic to the setting, but also, like you said, it, you know, definitely could be a kind of way of poking fun at some of the characters. You know, Anna definitely brings that up with her husband a few times when they're in situations where she's frustrated with him. So yeah, it was one of those things that it felt very Miami, but it also, I think, worked really well with what I wanted to do with the story and with the characters, and kind of a little tongue in cheek of some of the personalities that we see in the book. The other thing is they really do make very scary screams. And so it just felt, I mean, it can sound like a person screaming. And so it just felt like such an organic thing to add to a gothic, that you'd be in this remote mansion and all of a sudden hear, you know, what sounds very similar to a human scream. And really it's just the peacocks. But, you know, you wouldn't necessarily know. And if you were tired from travels and had been through a lot, you know, that would kind of play tricks on you.
Well, you did so many fun things with them, because yes, the human scream was funny, because I lived four houses down from someone who had peacocks, and I know that scream very well, and you were completely right. And so, you know, I was like, oh man, these peacocks are doing so much work. I love it. It was such a good time, because the men were also peacocks, like the whole opulence of everything. And then there was a labyrinth and peacocks and murders. And it was just so much fun. I was like, this is so glitzy, you know.
Well, but I love too that they were able to put them on the cover. That was one thing, you know, when we were talking about the cover with my publisher, I was like, oh, I'd really love if we could, like, the peacock feathers. And they did such a cool job, I thought, of incorporating that on the cover as well. So I was very excited to have that detail there.
Oh yeah, it looked great. I mean, it looks so inviting, the colors and everything too. It was just beautiful. I love that cover. so much. Well, you did something in this book that I've spoken about a few times when I'm talking about ghost stories, which is that we can sometimes forget the humanity behind them. And you showed how legends can form while people in the stories are still very much alive, like relatives are still alive. And I think this is important when we think about our fascination of like true crime or just ghost stories in general. And can you speak to why it was important to you to include this in the story as a writer?
So those are kind of also themes that I tend to revisit in my books. And with writing The House of Biscayne Bay, I knew that it was going to be a little bit of a departure for me because it is my first Gothic. But I also wanted to honor, you know, the readership that I have that's been, you know, so supportive for me through all of my historical fiction books. And so I wanted to include those elements that, you know, they have come to enjoy in my books and then also kind of put a new spin on it. So a lot of what I write really deals with, you know, generational trauma and legacies and how the past sort of impacts the present. And so I wanted to take that framework and put it in this Gothic setting where you have a mystery that has this kind of parallel, and you know that what's happening in the present is somewhat affected by the past, and Carbet is kind of having to figure out how those connections intersect. And then also the idea of the house, kind of how you said, you know, we don't meet it in a state of decay, but we meet it having been through, you know, the reader knows some kind of trauma and having to be rebuilt. And so that idea of the house almost having its own legacy and its own secrets and being kind of a almost a living, breathing entity in the novel, where it's a character in its own self. And that setting really is kind of taking center stage, which was what was important to me. And I think that's what, as a reader, I love about Gothics, is when you feel like you are completely immersed in this setting that feels very real to you.
I found it interesting, the age of the characters in the story, which I think is actually accurate for the time as far as like when they would have been married or experienced this level of loss or when they would have been caught up in a Gothic. I mean, when you go back and you look at Rebecca and everything, they're ingenues. But I think you typically write a range of age and everything. What drew you to this age for this story?
So I think for Anna, you know, like I said, she came to me first, and I just saw her having been someone who'd been married for a long time. And, you know, once again, I was kind of playing with that idea of appearances. And so just like not everything in Miami is like it seems, not everything in Marbrisa is like it seems, not everything in Anna's marriage is perhaps like she thinks it is. And sort of that idea that you could live, you know, decades of your life with someone and find out that there are still secrets and things that you don't know, and what it would be like to be unraveling all of that in a new place where you don't have a huge support network, you know, where you're not really familiar with the area. And so that was kind of the impetus for her storyline and why I put her at the point in her life that she's in, because I wanted her to sort of go through that transformation. At that point where I felt like she had lived a lifetime with this man, but also still had, you know, all of this time ahead of her. And so she was at sort of a crossroads on what her decisions are going to be. And then with Carmen, really it was this idea of her also sort of coming to a place that she didn't have a lot of connection, didn't have a lot of ties. And really, like you said, kind of what felt age appropriate at the time period for her on whether or not she would have been married. And what kind of opportunities would have been available to her. And I specifically wrote both storylines during, you know, the first one is right after World War One has ended. And then the second one is right before the United States is going to get involved in World War II. It's right before Pearl Harbor takes place. And I wanted both characters to feel like they're on the precipice of change, both personally, but then also externally, as they knew that the world around them was going to be transforming. But they didn't know exactly what that would look like for them yet or how they would find a place for themselves in that. So there was a part of that too, and trying to figure out what season of life they were going to be in. And Carmen's, you know, looking at educational opportunities or career, or what will she do, you know, now that her parents are gone, she's sort of on her own.
You touched on something that I think is really important to that answer, which is it's a dual timeline. And a lot of times, not all the time, but a lot of times when we see dual timelines, it's two characters that are the same age. And I do like that you had Anna at a completely different phase of her life than Carmen and Catalina. And so I found that really interesting too. You know, it just happens so often that when you see dual timelines, it's like this person that's 22 years old is, and then you get another point of view from like, I don't know, 50 years before of someone else who was 20 years old in the story. And And then they try to put the pieces together. But that's not what you did here. And I think as a narrative choice, that's really interesting because the pieces you're trying to put together shouldn't feel like they should connect, you know, mm-hmm. but they do. And that it's one is critical, like one doesn't exist without the other. So from a writing point of view, if you don't mind me asking you a writing sure. question, what's that process like for you? Do you write one story then the other, or do you find yourself going, okay, here's an Anna chapter, and then you go right into Carmen's chapter? Like how does this work for you?
So I do a lot of multiple timelines. Pretty much all of my books have multiple timelines. And for me, I write in Scrivener. So if you're not familiar with the program, it's really great for moving scenes around, and you can also color code scenes. So I'll, you know, color code the scenes for the characters. But I write the book, I don't really write in order, but I also write, I'll kind of switch back and forth between characters. So often what that means is when I'm going through the revision process, I'm moving scenes around because I'll realize, okay, there's a reveal in this chapter, so I need to move this scene up or I need to move it back. But really, I sort of write what comes to me at the time. I'm a big pantser. I don't plot a ton. And
you're
so
my
I
favorite
often
for saying that. It's so hard for me to move forward, like plotting. Yeah, but it comes so naturally as I'm typing, like things just happen. Anyway, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I love talking about craft. No, for me, I think, like you said, I have tried to outline and do that. And I think because so much of my novels are often inspired by the history. So often in my research or going down a kind of rabbit hole in my history, that'll take the novel in a different direction. And then also my characters really, you know, I'll find that maybe I thought they would react a certain way, but then as I'm writing, I'm like, oh, that doesn't really feel organic to the character that I've built. And so it takes me in kind of a new direction. But yeah, I do skip around and I do write them, you know, kind of at the same time. And then often in revisions, that's when I know where I need to move or make breaks or maybe add a character here or there. And then one thing I learned with my first historical fiction that was really helpful for me is that when I do dual timelines or multiple timelines, I will read all of the scenes for one character in one go, and then all the scenes, because I want to make sure that I still have a cohesive arc that stands independently on its own without having to lend itself too heavily to the other timeline. Like I feel like they should be interwoven and they should support each other, but they should not prop each other up. And so it's kind of making sure that still, they're still two separate, you know, distinctive arcs.
Oh, that's so cool. That's a really interesting point. So I'm going to keep that in mind when I open up my work in progress this today. Like I'm ready to go back and dive in. And I also love knowing I haven't been able to read your previous books because I have to read for the show every week, but mm-hmm. I love Cuban history. And there's just such beauty, you know, every time I've gone in and read a story. So I'm excited to spend this summer when I get my break, diving into your backlist. I'm so excited now. Well, you've written, I mean, you're fabulous. You're popular. People love you. You've been like on Reese's, you know, Reese Witherspoon's book club. But I do believe that this is your first Gothic. I know, like I said, you've got tons of readers who've been with you on your journey as a writer, but you know, do you feel like you're going to be doing a little bit more Gothic after this? How was this experience for you?
I really loved it. This was just a really fun book for me to write. I liked that I could have kind of the historical framework for the book and what the time period was like and how that would affect my characters. But I also liked the freedom to create this fictional house and to be able to play with, you know, the noises and the characters and the setting and just all of those things. I've been kind of a lifelong Gothic reader. And so for me, it was fun. I like to write what I like to read. And so this was a genre that I've always loved as a reader, but I have not had the opportunity to write in. So it was very cool to get to explore that. And I would love to do more in the future. My next book is not Gothic, but you know, who knows after that, I think it would be fun to do more. Cause it was a very cool experience, definitely.
Oh, that's so fun. Well, are you allowed to tell us what's next? Is it too early?
So I can probably say a little bit because the deal was announced a bit ago, but it's a dual timeline. Well, it's actually three timelines, and it's kind of Cuban American history, basically 20th century kind of early, and then a present day timeline as well. So it's sort of my love letter to books and exploring a few different periods in Cuban history. So I'm excited to be able to share more. I just turned it in to my editor, so I haven't gotten edits back or anything yet. So I'm still kind of not quite ready to say too much, but we'll see. You know, I'm excited. It should be out, I think, next summer is kind of what we're going for.
Oh, that sounds amazing, though. I'm looking forward to that, too. And summers are my break, so that's going to be like perfect timing for me. So, Oh, well, thank you so much for joining me today. I can't wait to share this episode with everybody. And I can't wait for, you know, to start seeing my listeners tell me about their experience reading the book and everything. So I really appreciate your time. Thanks so much for joining me today.
Thank you. This was wonderful. I really appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining me today on She Wore Black. If you like what you heard and want to support my work on the show, you can visit my website at sheworeblackpodcast.com for links to my Patreon, my coffee donation site, as well as my merch and my online bookshop. You can also help out the show by rating me on Apple and following me on Instagram, Facebook, and Threads, and letting your friends know about the show. Thanks for joining me today. And happy reading.